So the topic is bright X-ray sources and M31 globular clusters. I will focus on the observations, but I think there's some very interesting possible explanations for what we see that have implications for what we can look for, and in fact have in some cases already looked for in other galaxies. And there's a kind of a subtext or sub-narrative that will weave through this as we look at the implications. That is, as we go beyond M31, there's a kind of a saga involving soft sources. And I'll talk a little bit about the motivation for it to start that out, and when we come back in the end, you'll see why I'm emphasizing it now. Okay, now this was a set. I'll show you this field 1, field 2, and field 3. Were part of a survey of M31 that was carried out by Chandra in 2001. And the point of this survey was really, or the objectives were really threefold. One, I was very interested in a class of source called luminous supersoft X-ray sources. Because they're soft, we can't see them very well through the galactic disk, so we look toward other galaxies to get statistical samples of them. And in particular, what we tried to do was to position these three fields so that the chip that Josh talked about, that's very sensitive to soft X radiation right around here, S3, would be centered on a place that had supersoft sources, 5 in all over all three fields, in each of 3 separate Chandra ACES-S observations. That was the first goal. We also chose the positions to optimize the numbers of globular clusters, because that was an important second goal of these observations, was to study the X-ray sources in M31 globular clusters. And then the third goal, you can see from the positioning of the fields, we wanted these fields to be spread throughout the galaxy. The idea was not to do a source-by-source count throughout the whole galaxy, but to pick 3 characteristic and different environments in which we could study both supersoft sources and globular clusters. So we have something way out from the center of the galaxy, something very close to the center, and something that is a bit off the minor axis. And actually, you can see these yellow symbols here turn out to be supernova remnants. So you can see that this third field actually contains some activity from these star-forming regions, as does field 2. So how do things differ as you go to different fields? Well, that was the plan, and we were lucky enough that it was approved. And this was the set of the first observations that were done. They were actually done in November of 2000. We started really doing a serious analysis in January of 2001. And I want to emphasize, you know, who my collaborators are on this, a very strong set of observers from both optical and X-ray wavelengths. Much of the X-ray analysis was done by Albert Kong with good backup and in fact, initialization by Jochen Greiner. And Pauline Barmby played an important role in connecting up our globular cluster work at X-ray wavelengths with the optical data. So, we were very eager. Jochen came from Germany to spend a week to look at the supersoft sources that were in the data. And at the end of the week, we had a group meeting, and the story was not a single one of the 5 sources was on. Nothing. And that didn't mean there weren't some other soft sources there, but they were kind of hard to pick out. They weren't as obvious as we had thought. So it was a bit depressing. And toward the end of the meeting, he said, you know, there's one very interesting thing in there. There's a very bright source that happens to be in a globular cluster. It's more than 10 to the 38 ergs per second. And that source was located at the edge of this chip over here. It's associated with the globular cluster discovered by the Bologna group, BO375. So we were pretty excited about that, and of course, being very naive, I thought, ah, we have a black hole in a globular cluster. It hasn't been done before. That's great. We looked at the spectrum. This was done by Albert Kong. And in this particular data, this was our own ACES-S data, we had about 7,000 photons. Indeed, the fit tells us that the luminosity just between 0.3 and 7 keV was over 10 to the 38 ergs per second. 4.2, I think, times 10 to the 38 ergs per second. So I was stunned and saying, well, this is great. But on the other hand, the question was, how could this be? Because there had been a ROSAT paper that said that, in fact, or at least it was interpreted by me, and I think by some others, to say that the maximum luminosity of X-ray bright globular clusters is comparable between the galaxy, the Milky Way, and M31. So actually, not having the observational skills of my colleagues, I was a bit worried that maybe we weren't really looking at something that was quite this luminous. And I think we all questioned what it was that we were actually discovering. So Albert went back and he looked at 20 years of observations by Einstein, ROSAT, OSCA, and finally Chandra, and found that they all agree that the bolometric luminosity of this source has always been observed or estimated to be above 2 times 10 to the 38 ergs per second. We checked with the ROSAT people as well, and they agreed, and they just said, well, that's the last point in our luminosity function. So they had found it, and I think everyone agrees that this is a highly luminous source. In fact, it is still, as far as I know, the most luminous source in the M31 globular cluster system, among the globular cluster sources, and same is true for the galaxy. We followed this story a little bit further, because it turns out that Bol 375 is not the only bright globular cluster source in M31. In fact, there are three or four sources that have luminosities near or above 10 to the 38 ergs per second. And this is out of roughly 30 sources. One in three sources has a luminosity above 10 to the 37 ergs per second. And if you paid very close attention to one of Josh's early transparencies, you'll know that that's not true in the Milky Way. In the Milky Way, only one of it's 12 globular clusters, 13 sources, right? But only one of these has ever been observed to be as luminous as about 5 times 10 to the 37. All the others are below 10 to the 37. So we were very intrigued by this. And, you know, we threw all the energy that was going into super soft sources at first into studying these bright globular clusters. Now, I just want to mention that M31's globular cluster sources stand out not only when they're compared with those in our own galaxy, but they also stand out compared to other M31 X-ray sources. This is from a paper by Kang et al. That should appear in March. It's on AstroPH. And you can see that in field 1, field 2, and field 3, there aren't very many particularly luminous sources. The central field, so now this includes data, as does the estimate of the 30 extra globular cluster sources. It contains data from the central field collected by Steve Murray and Mike Garcia. I want to mention that. The central field is basically from their data sets. And there are bright sources in the central field. But actually, the brightest source in the galaxy is Bol 375. And in fact, it's a very interesting thing that if you took M31, if you placed it in the Virgo cluster and you asked yourself, what would you see? You would see only a handful of sources. At least half of them would be in globular clusters. Okay, so it's a good lesson for looking at other galaxies, I think. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. 10 to the 38 is right there. I can barely read it myself. There it is. All of this, well, this is from Kang et al., which is available on AstroPH. All the rest of it on the M31 globular clusters is in the reference I pointed out earlier, which appeared this year in APJ. Now, Pauline Barmby did an extensive analysis looking for differences between the M31 globular clusters and galactic globular clusters with X-ray sources, the M31 globular clusters with X-ray sources versus without them. And very few differences emerged. In fact, the only one she thought was worth discussing was that in M31, the globular clusters with X-ray sources are, on average, brighter by a factor of about 1.7 in flux. And the other thing, which is known, and it could also be determined from Josh's transparency, for the Milky Way, the distance that globular clusters with X-ray sources have from the center of our galaxy forms a function something like this. So this is now this projected distance from the center, and this is the fraction of globular clusters that have X-ray sources. And you can see that that function falls off with distance. For M31, we looked at the fraction of all globular clusters with X-ray sources. But there are great uncertainties because only some of the M31 globular clusters are confirmed globular clusters. It's much more dramatic if you just confine yourself to the confirmed globular clusters. So what are the explanations for what's going on? Well, I don't have a definitive explanation. I'll just show you some of the questions we asked. First of all, of course, we asked if this Bol 375 was a multiple. There was some evidence in the image that it might be, and we have follow-up observations with the HRC to look at it more closely. Could it be a black hole? Well, very hard to tell the spectral difference between a black hole and a neutron star based on this type of X-ray spectra we have. I don't know that it is a black hole. Is it perhaps beamed? Maybe, but I don't know. There was some interesting evidence. I mentioned that there was a little bit of structure in the image, and that's a complicated story that I'll leave for another time. But we also discovered the source to be variable over several different observations. And intriguingly enough, the ROSAT people, when they observed this cluster, found evidence for a characteristic timescale of variability of about 16 hours. So they didn't claim an orbital period, but they did have variability on a timescale of 16 hours. And here again, the supersoft source theme comes back. Because when I heard that, having worked on the binary evolution of supersoft sources some years before, immediately thought, well, that could be a system that's undergoing mass transfer on the thermal timescale of the donor. And I worked out a model in which that happened, and I can tell you more about it. I think I'd like to leave this aside for a few moments and see if we have time to come back to it later on. But I worked out a model and ran many thousands of binary evolutions to see whether or not a thermal time scale mass transfer system could have the properties that we see in Bol 375. I made the assumption that the 16 hours corresponds to a period, which is a wild jump, but why not try it out? And in fact, what you would find is that you could, in fact, achieve luminosities that were comparable. I actually cut these off at the Eddington limit with orbital periods in the right range in both the conservative and non-conservative mass transfer evolution. If you started with donor masses that were something above one solar mass, and these donors had to generally be at least slightly evolved, have helium cores of about between 0.1 and 0.15 solar masses for this to happen. And so then the issue is, well, this is the companion star mass over here. This is the mass of the companion star. It's a main sequence star. Well, it's a star that's coming off the main sequence. Excuse me? I'm assuming it's a neutron star. That's what I'm assuming. Yeah, why not? And explored the range of possible masses. You don't actually have to go as high as the masses I showed in that graph do. And they seem to be perfectly viable binary evolutions. So that leads to a conjecture. Perhaps thermal timescale mass transfer is taking place. This is mass transfer taking place on the thermal timescale of the donor star. Generally, let me just say a word about it at least. This happens when, as a result of mass transfer, the donor star wants to expand, but the Roche lobe, as a result of the mass transfer, is either shrinking or is not expanding as quickly as the equilibrium radius of the donor star would be expanding. So the donor star is sort of eager to get out of that Roche lobe, and this pushes mass transfer on the thermal time scale of the donor. And as far as I know, these were first done in the context of supersoft sources, and now, in fact, they have been done for many other systems. And I know Philip has worked on this, and Melvin has worked on this, and many other people. Andrew has worked on this. Many other people have worked on this sort of evolution. Okay, now how can you test this? And this comes back to a question that Lars asked yesterday of Philip. Well, first of all, in M31, you may hope to measure variability. If not to actually extract an orbital period, you can look at the bright sources and see if there's evidence for variability on timescales that range from 10 hours maybe to a day and a half or 2 days. That's one thing you can do. But the other thing you can do is you can conduct tests based on cluster properties if you can develop statistics on a large number of clusters. Now, M31 does have a large number of clusters compared to the Milky Way, but if we look at some elliptical galaxies, they have on the order of 1,000 clusters, and by looking at both ellipticals and spirals outside of the Milky Way, we can really expand our sample significantly. The kinds of questions you might ask is, in these systems where we see bright globular clusters, do they have turnoff masses that are greater than 0.8 solar masses? So, for example, are these more massive stars perhaps ordinary globular cluster stars that are near the turnoff? In this case, you would predict that you find bright X-ray sources in young globular clusters. That can be checked. Or another physical possibility is that the system is actually a blue straggler neutron star system, so that the more massive star that is the donor was formed through one or a sequence of interactions that left a merged remnant of perhaps two other stars in orbit with the neutron star. In this case, you would expect to find such bright sources in globular clusters where the rate of interactions in the core is high. So you might look for them in, say, very massive or very centrally concentrated globular clusters. And again, you can hope to test this statistically. And that was the next step in our research program. But before we do it, I'd like to visit the halo of M31, as XMM is going to do several times next week as part of the follow-up program. This was actually data taken by XMM for Frank Verbund. Here's the famous G1. There's nothing published on this, but there is an X-ray source, a garden variety, 2×10^36 erg per second source. And there are sources in its environment. We have crafted a program to study, well, we wanted 10 spots, but we got 5. So now it's 5 regions in the halo of M31, and in one of those regions, it will include the position of G1. This is very relevant to what people were saying, have been talking about during this workshop, and in particular what Josh just said. If you look in the region of G1, and I think G1 is now this source over here, this is a 30 arc minute region. What you find is that there are many, many X-ray sources around it. And you begin to perhaps be able to test the hypothesis that these sources come from the cluster, thank you, or else possibly there are too many of them to come from the cluster. Many of these, that's right. I mean, the density is, that's right. And I haven't done these calculations for the XMM calculations, but we know that in the Chandra calculations, on the order of 10 sources for our exposure time are likely to be background sources. And it could very well be that you have to subtract a number of sources. And I think this was a 10 kilosecond observation. It wasn't very long, but XMM is sensitive. So you certainly do have to subtract out a certain number of those sources, and I'm not quite sure what it is. This is not our work. This is just pulling off the image to see if there was something interesting in that region, basically. In fact, we will be observing next week this region, including G1 at the edge of the field. We'll be exploring this region of the halo.
And there are some indications. First of all, the stellar density is very low. It's 40 kiloparsecs from the nucleus. That's 3 degrees angular distance from the sky.
Right.
You see the red plot. It's sort of visible, but there seems to be a rising luminosity function. And when you fit that luminosity function thing, you get a population about 4 to 6 meters. What's interesting is that the red giants in that field have kinematics that is very close to the rotation field, very close to neutral hydrogen, about 2 kiloparsecs distance.
Oh, I see.
So that the population
so it might not be Right. That could very well be, right. And I look forward to talking with you about that, because I understand the HST program to study this, to study the halo of M31 is just having tremendously beautiful results, and clearly there's some contact to be made here. Okay, well then this is a okay. Someday someone will. Now I wanted to inject a note of caution about our assumption that all of the X-ray sources in globular clusters around ellipticals come from the, well, all of the X-ray sources come from globular clusters, but I'm going to leave that off because there's something very interesting I want to tell you about before my time is up. And that's some observations that were done by Muzhatsky and his group of an elliptical galaxy about 16 megaparsecs away called NGC 4472. And actually, the work on this that you should be referred to, this is not published. This was a sad story. We had an undergrad who came to CFA this summer to work on a project. And we asked Pauline, well, we'd love to do this archival project. Which cluster, which galaxy should we look at? And she said, let's pick out a nice juicy one. And the problem with juicy ones is there's usually somebody else working on them. So the day after he finished and extracted his X-ray sources, there was a paper on the web by Arunav, so it's Kundu, Makarone, and Zepf, doing the X-ray analysis of the sources in this galaxy. So we had to do something new with it, right? We couldn't let the student go home empty-handed. All of this is consistent with what they found. We analyzed all 6 chips, so we have a few extra sources. But there were 118 X-ray sources, 40 of them in globular clusters. We estimate by doing a randomization process that 6 of these matches are spurious matches. And I had spent a good part of the summer trying to develop an algorithm to look for supersoft sources in other galaxies. So the new thing that we did was to apply this algorithm to the sources in the field. And we did check over here, there's very small probability that any of these soft sources are background sources. We actually did a comparison with the CHAMP data to make sure that we wouldn't be picking up this type of source in the CHAMP data with this kind of frequency. But anyway, these were associated with globular clusters. Our estimate is that since 6 out of 40 are likely to be spurious, it's unlikely that these 6 identifications are spurious. Are they real supersoft sources? Some of them are much harder than we typically associate with that word. So let me tell you about the sources. I'll also give you a bit of background. In our galaxy, there's one supersoft source that has been observed in the globular cluster M3 by Josh and his group and by Frank Verbund and his group. Has a luminosity of about 10 to the 36th ergs per second. And Melvin and I did a little work to see, first of all, would we have seen other sources if they were in the, like that, if they were in the galaxy, globular clusters? The answer is yes, you have a very high probability to see them if they were on when you looked with ROSAT. So there probably aren't any others. And also, how many of these would you expect to see using standard binary evolution models? And the answer was probably about one at any given time in the galactic globular cluster system. These sources are different because we get admittedly a very small number of counts, but something like 15 or 20 counts from each at a distance of 16 megaparsecs. They're highly luminous. And one of the sources, source 185, just doing a comparison with the count rate in soft, medium, and hard bins with PIMS, would be consistent with a temperature between about 125 and 175 EV and a luminosity of 5 × 10⁻³⁷ ergs per second. This source could possibly be a nuclear burning white dwarf. And this would be remarkable to have found such a source in a globular cluster. This would have to involve some type of a scenario. Thank you. This would be basically a thermal timescale mass transfer scenario onto a massive white dwarf. It's not been seen before. The other five sources, interestingly enough, are somewhat harder. Again, we're really doing estimates of the temperature here that may not be very reliable. But they all have some radiation in the medium band, that's between 1.1 and 2 keV. So these are not your standard 50 EV supersoft sources. They have estimated luminosities of about 10 to the 38 ergs per second. And as I said, they're too hot to be nuclear burning white dwarfs. Not only that, but there aren't very many known X-ray sources that are this luminous that have this kind of spectrum. If you assume that you're looking at an accretion system with a thin disk, you can determine the mass of the accretor. If we do that for each of these five sources, we derive masses between 50 and 100 solar masses. Could this be wrong? Absolutely. There are lots of ways for this to be wrong. We've checked some of them. For example, the temperature that we are measuring is not really the effective temperature. This black hole could be spinning, so maybe the inner disk is actually in closer than we're assuming. And we could very well have, in fact, we certainly have underestimated the luminosity because we're looking only in these Chandra bands at something that's very soft. But each of these effects, if we would, any correction we could make for these effects would up the mass of the central accreting object. There is one potential problem in that if you compute the luminosity and you say what fraction is it of Eddington, it's around a percent or a couple of percent, then you begin to wonder if your disk model is actually correct. So what do we have here? Well, I don't really know, but it's intriguing whatever it is because we have no other examples of it. And in fact, we're very seriously exploring the possibility that we have evidence of 50 to 100 solar mass black holes in some of the globular clusters of NGC 4472. This is true, we should find them in other globular cluster systems as well. But as I said, whatever they are so far in our experience, absolutely unique. So what is our story? Well, we started out in M31 with these bright X-ray sources, having been disappointed in our search for supersoft sources. We found some intriguing evidence of this thermal timescale mass transfer, which caused us to look out at other galaxies. And in that search, we've discovered some intriguing new sources which have signatures that are like, but perhaps somewhat harder than typical supersoft sources. And these are the intriguing sources I'd like to leave you with. So the end of the story is that the study of X-ray sources in the globular cluster system of other galaxies will, and some of the talks tomorrow will certainly take us further along these lines, will provide us with amazing new opportunities, I think. Thank you.
Oh,
that's rare.
Hi, Roseanne. There's a paper by Koji Mukai and collaborators recently about an object which I think is vaguely similar.
That's an object in M101. It's an ultra-luminous source. That source has
a
luminosity.
It's 10 to the 39.
It's consistently above 10 to the 39, although there are observations in which it's been somewhat, some four times less luminous than Koji says. Notice these guys are not ultra-luminous.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing about them. But we agree with Koji on that. We've studied M101.
His interpretation of that is that that's an ordinary stellar mass black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Close to its Eddington limit. Because you're near the Eddington limit, you have outflow, and you don't have any freedom in deciding what the optical depth in that outflow is. You simply get a photosphere which is comes out to be the size of a rather small white dwarf, which is indeed what you have. So you
that
get
could
the
be.
Sort of ATV temperatures quite naturally, I think.
That's right. And actually, you know, one could... There are two possible other explanations here. There's a white dwarf explanation where you're having a hardening of the spectrum for reasons that, you know, one is still a bit vague on. It's really ad hoc models. Or one could have an accreting neutron star. And if it's an accreting neutron star, it just so happens the photosphere has some unusual size that's about 100 times bigger than a neutron star, but somewhat smaller than a typical white dwarf. It's certainly a viable model, and that may be what we're seeing as well.
The same thing, I assume.
I haven't done the numbers, but I assume that Koji's calculation would also work for a neutron star. I mean, the point is you don't have to have these extreme masses. You can get away with it because you make your photosphere larger because of the outflow.
Absolutely. But I think it's a good thing to do to consider this black hole model because, as you know, there was this Aspen meeting which introduced me basically to ultra-luminous sources. And a lot of the discussion there was, we have these very luminous sources and maybe they're massive black holes, but if any of them are, why aren't they soft? And here we see these models that just exactly fit the disk model, the thin disk model, which everybody was wondering, why don't we have sources that fit that? And now people are saying maybe we should expect these types of black holes and globular clusters. So I would be remiss not to mention this possibility, I think. But I certainly am not claiming it's a definitive model. Right?
I don't know how to prolong this, but this has to be very rare.
Absolutely, yes.
Can you say anything about what's special about those globular clusters that have these sources in them? Are they, for example, younger than others?
Arunav? Right. I don't know if you've actually looked at that yet, Arunav, have you? I'm just talking about these six globular clusters.
But they're almost certainly not younger. Right. This is one of the lessons from this morning. Is that, I mean, we have identified systems with younger clusters, but 4472 is not one of them. So it may be, this is where Gene Brody's 2 to 4 giga-year limit comes in. Within about 4 giga-years, they're not, you know, younger than Hubble time minus 4 giga-years.
Did I show you where they were? I guess I did show you, I might not have emphasized. They're not located in any one particular place. They're kind of spread out, which I thought was kind of interesting. So some of them are not at the center, but close to the galaxy center, and some of them are way off from the galaxy center. According to Arunav, with one exception, these are very good candidates for globular clusters. You know, you might wonder, are we looking at something that's not a globular cluster? We very well could be, and maybe in at least one or two of these cases we are, but certainly not in all six cases. Okay.
This is sort of more of an advertisement for extragalactic studies in this vein, like your last slide. If there are only six of them in NGC 4472 like this, NGC 4472 has 40 times more globulars than our own galaxy. So it's actually, you won't find rare objects like this looking at the globular cluster systems of our own galaxy, and even M31 is 3 times richer than that. So there's a reason, if there are unusual sources, that you pick them up in these systems, but not in the local group galaxies.
Right. And actually, I should mention that what I spent most of the summer doing was developing an algorithm to identify soft sources in other galaxies. And the difficult thing is, when you have 10 to 20 or 50 photons, how do you really make an identification? I think it's rather tricky, and you have to be very careful. So we have subclassified sources according to what part of our algorithm identifies them. But with the exception, none of these are the softest of the sources we should be able to find. As soon as we've had a chance to test this algorithm out on another handful of galaxies, I'll make it public domain, and anybody who's been looking at X-ray sources in any other galaxy can just take it and search for those sources, and I'm sure you'll find similar things to this if you apply it enough times.
Yes, I have more comment, also perhaps a question to Josh. In the global cluster system of the Milky Way, in M15, there's AC211, which is an accretion disk corona system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's believed that you don't see most of the X-rays because of the disk.
Yeah.
And I know that Phil Charles tells me that he thinks it's a source that has a luminosity of order the adic luminosity.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be quite luminous.
Mm-hmm.
What is just... Yes.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting that you may have found some evidence for black holes in globular clusters. As you know, we don't really think they should be very common. But now I hear that there are 40 times more globular clusters in this galaxy than in our own galaxy. I get a little bit relieved. Though if there are like 100 solar mass objects, you could imagine that you cannot kick them out of globular clusters so easily. So you will remain them in the center. So once in a while, you can expect an object like this, I guess.
Right. I should mention, by the way, we find sources like this not just in the globular clusters. The total number of soft sources we identified, I think I may have had on one of these transparencies, is approximately 25. And only a few of there are a few that are very, very soft and are very likely to satisfy the standard super soft source paradigm. But there are a number of other sources like this that are not below 100 EV, and I think you can't really push the nuclear burning model if you're seeing the burning photosphere. If that's what you're seeing, you can't push that model to luminosities, to temperatures any higher than about 150 EV. So, and we see other sources whose temperatures, which we get by a very crude method, okay, I'm not proud of it, but you have 20 photons, so you have to do something, and we do a very crude comparison. But these temperatures are probably also in the range of about 200, 250 EV. So these aren't unique in 4472, but these are the ones that happen to be in globular clusters.
Yeah,